English Listening Comprehension Test C2 Level, Valencian Community 2016. Now you will hear the instructions for the listening test. You will have time to read all the questions for all the tasks in the exam. At the beginning of each listening, you will hear this sound. You can make notes or write your answers while you are listening, but remember that you will also have time to write your answers at the end of each exercise. Please read the instructions for each exercise carefully. If you have any questions, ask them now, as you will not be able to talk during the listening test. Please look at task 1. You will hear a BBC Two lecture where Mark Steele talks about Albert Einstein. For questions 1 to 7, choose the correct answer, A, B or C. Write your answers in the appropriate boxes below. Question 0 is an example. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1.5 minutes to read the questions.
Einstein was born in 1879 in the south of Germany and was deemed a failure at school.
The Dyslexic Society claims he was dyslexic.
But in some ways, he had a different sort of intelligence to other kids. For example, when he was first shown his newborn sister, he said...
Yes, but where are its wheels?
Until Einstein was 9, he hardly spoke. His parents consulted a doctor and then hired a private tutor, but Einstein threw a tantrum and it was reported that...
He grabbed a chair and struck at the teacher, who was so terrified that she ran away and was never seen again.
But once he was 13, he developed two obsessions, the violin and a compass that his dad gave him when he was ill.
Einstein was always careful to remember the importance of youthful inspiration. He said,
"The most beautiful experience we can have is the mysterious. Whoever does not know it and can no longer wonder, no longer marvel, is as good as dead."
Einstein had to start national service at 17, so instead he left the country and renounced his German citizenship. He spent his time wandering around art galleries in Italy, and then went even further and renounced his Jewish faith altogether, and the enormity of this could easily be lost.
Eventually, he moved to where he could best pursue his scientific interests and came to Switzerland.
Einstein went to college in Zurich, by which time his rebellious spirit, his intellect and his violin playing was making him a hit with the women. He applied to loads of scientists asking if he could be their assistant, but didn't get a single reply, which didn't seem to bother him much, as he could spend all day studying and playing the violin.
By this time, Einstein had fallen in love with another physicist called Mileva, who his mother detested to the extent she said,
"No decent family will have her. By the time you're 30, she'll be an old witch."
In 1902, he started working over there at the patent office, and Einstein and Mileva got married soon after. He spent the next 3 years of his life writing the theories that would redefine the way the human race thought about space and time. And throughout this time, he barely thought about anything else, even after they'd had a child.
In every bit of his spare time, he kept working, which didn't help his marriage, as his wife then announced that she'd lost all interest in physics. So his obsessive methods helped to wreck his marriage, but the good news was it did mean he was able to write a groundbreaking paper on the random movement of pollen, and then he turned to light. Einstein had literally rewritten the laws of physics. For 200 years, there'd been no scientific dispute against Newton's belief that time and space were immovable, but Einstein replaced that by saying,
"There is no absolute meaning to the statement of the time of an event."
He had another child with Mileva, Edward, and travelled around Europe to lecture. But his living conditions were worse than ever. According to one account,
Einstein was crawling with so many fleas, he had to take a bath.
Despite this, while in Berlin, he met his cousin Elsa. She was fascinated by physics and gave poetry readings, and the two fell in love in the way that cousins seemed to back then. The situation put a certain strain on his marriage.
Einstein drew up a set of conditions that Mileva had to sign for the two of them to carry on living together.
Einstein, I go.
"You make sure that my clothes and laundry are kept in good order and repair. You do without, one, my sitting at home with you, two, my going out or travelling with you. In your relations with me, you are neither to expect intimacy from me or reproach me in any way. You must leave my bedroom or office immediately if I request it."
Eventually, he took a job in Berlin, leaving Mileva and his children, the deal being that if he won the Nobel Prize, which he expected to, he would give her the money.
Exactly. Einstein's move to Germany came in 1914, just in time for the First World War. And then almost every organisation across Germany supported it. A group of leading intellectuals issued a manifesto to the civilised world, declaring that,
"Were it not for German militarism, German culture would have been wiped off the face of the earth."
One of Einstein's heroes, Max Planck, signed it, and 91 other prominent academics, including Wilhelm Röntgen, the man who discovered X-rays. Einstein was asked to sign it, but instead he drew up his own manifesto, denouncing the war. He circulated it with a friend, but they only got two others to sign. But throughout, he remained, above all, a physicist. He was indeed awarded the Nobel Prize and gave the money to Mileva. Part of what annoyed Einstein is the media always asked for soundbite explanations for his theories.
Albert Einstein, in layman's terms, how would you describe the theory of relativity?
Well, it's...
When a competition was set up for who could give the best explanation of relativity in 3,000 words, Einstein said,
"I shan't enter, for it isn't possible."
Einstein had another problem. An anti-Semitic group called the German Natural Philosophers was formed, obsessed with discrediting him. And at one of their rallies, Einstein hired a box and sat there going along with the whole thing, clapping at the most absurd comments. The German Natural Philosophers complained about the
Jewish nature of relativity.
A series of prominent German Jews were assassinated. So without telling Einstein, Elsa ensured whenever he toured, there were secret policemen protecting him. By the time Hitler came to power in 1933, it was becoming impossible for Einstein. So, 164 leading Jewish professors were sacked. Einstein had his savings confiscated. And he had no illusions that the Nazis were a passing fad, so he accepted an offer to work in America.
Shortly after Einstein took up his position at Princeton University, there was a phone call to his office, and a man asked where Albert Einstein lived. So the secretary said, "Well, I can't give out that information," and asked who was calling. And the man said, "It's Albert Einstein, I've forgotten my address."
He toured the world addressing audiences on science and peace, but usually gave away his fee. And then, on the issue of peace, he changed his mind.
The Nazis were such a threat to civilization, he decided that a war against them could be justified. The world of science is my game.
Now, listen again.
Einstein was born in 1879 in the south of Germany and was deemed a failure at school.
The Dyslexic Society claims he was dyslexic.
But in some ways, he had a different sort of intelligence to other kids. For example, when he was first shown his newborn sister, he said...
Yes, but where are its wheels?
Until Einstein was 9, he hardly spoke. His parents consulted a doctor and then hired a private tutor, but Einstein threw a tantrum and it was reported that...
He grabbed a chair and struck at the teacher, who was so terrified that she ran away and was never seen again.
But once he was 13, he developed two obsessions, the violin and a compass that his dad gave him when he was ill.
Einstein was always careful to remember the importance of youthful inspiration. He said,
"The most beautiful experience we can have is the mysterious. Whoever does not know it and can no longer wonder, no longer marvel, is as good as dead."
Einstein had to start national service at 17, so instead he left the country and renounced his German citizenship. He spent his time wandering around art galleries in Italy, and then went even further and renounced his Jewish faith altogether, and the enormity of this could easily be lost.
Eventually, he moved to where he could best pursue his scientific interests and came to Switzerland.
Einstein went to college in Zurich, by which time his rebellious spirit, his intellect and his violin playing was making him a hit with the women. He applied to loads of scientists asking if he could be their assistant, but didn't get a single reply, which didn't seem to bother him much, as he could spend all day studying and playing the violin.
By this time, Einstein had fallen in love with another physicist called Mileva, who his mother detested to the extent she said,
"No decent family will have her. By the time you're 30, she'll be an old witch."
In 1902, he started working over there at the patent office, and Einstein and Mileva got married soon after. He spent the next 3 years of his life writing the theories that would redefine the way the human race thought about space and time. And throughout this time, he barely thought about anything else, even after they'd had a child.
In every bit of his spare time, he kept working, which didn't help his marriage, as his wife then announced that she'd lost all interest in physics. So his obsessive methods helped to wreck his marriage, but the good news was it did mean he was able to write a groundbreaking paper on the random movement of pollen, and then he turned to light. Einstein had literally rewritten the laws of physics. For 200 years, there'd been no scientific dispute against Newton's belief that time and space were immovable, but Einstein replaced that by saying,
"There is no absolute meaning to the statement of the time of an event."
He had another child with Mileva, Edward, and travelled around Europe to lecture, but his living conditions were worse than ever. According to one account,
Einstein was crawling with so many fleas, he had to take a bath.
Despite this, while in Berlin, he met his cousin Elsa. She was fascinated by physics and gave poetry readings, and the two fell in love in the way that cousins seemed to back then. The situation put a certain strain on his marriage.
Einstein drew up a set of conditions that Mileva had to sign for the two of them to carry on living together.
Einstein, I go.
"You make sure that my clothes and laundry are kept in good order and repair. You do without, one, my sitting at home with you, two, my going out or travelling with you. In your relations with me, you are neither to expect intimacy from me or reproach me in any way. You must leave my bedroom or office immediately if I request it."
Eventually, he took a job in Berlin, leaving Mileva and his children, the deal being that if he won the Nobel Prize, which he expected to, he would give her the money.
Exactly. Einstein's move to Germany came in 1914, just in time for the First World War. And then almost every organisation across Germany supported it. A group of leading intellectuals issued a manifesto to the civilised world, declaring that...
"Were it not for German militarism, German culture would have been wiped off the face of the earth."
One of Einstein's heroes, Max Planck, signed it, and 91 other prominent academics, including Wilhelm Röntgen, the man who discovered X-rays. Einstein was asked to sign it, but instead he drew up his own manifesto, denouncing the war. He circulated it with a friend, but they only got two others to sign. But throughout, he remained, above all, a physicist. He was indeed awarded the Nobel Prize and gave the money to Mileva. Part of what annoyed Einstein is the media always asked for soundbite explanations for his theories.
Albert Einstein, in layman's terms, how would you describe the theory of relativity?
Well, it's...
When a competition was set up for who could give the best explanation of relativity in 3,000 words, Einstein said...
I shan't enter, for it isn't possible.
Einstein had another problem. An anti-Semitic group called the German Natural Philosophers was formed, obsessed with discrediting him. And at one of their rallies, Einstein hired a box and sat there going along with the whole thing, clapping at the most absurd comments. The German Natural Philosophers complained about the...
Jewish nature of relativity.
A series of prominent German Jews were assassinated. So without telling Einstein, Elsa ensured whenever he toured, there were secret policemen protecting him. By the time Hitler came to power in 1933, it was becoming impossible for Einstein. So, 164 leading Jewish professors were sacked. Einstein had his savings confiscated. And he had no illusions that the Nazis were a passing fad, so he accepted an offer to work in America. Shortly after Einstein took up his position at Princeton University, there was a phone call to his office, and a man asked where Albert Einstein lived. So the secretary said, well, I can't give out that information, and asked who was calling. And the man said, it's Albert Einstein, I've forgotten my address. He toured the world addressing audiences on science and peace, but usually gave away his fee. And then, on the issue of peace, he changed his mind. The Nazis were such a threat to civilization, he decided, that a war against them could be justified. The world of science is my game.
Now you have 1 minute to check your answers. Please look at the second exercise. Listen to some extracts in which several people talk about food-related topics and match speakers 1 to 6 to the statements summarizing what each one says, B to I. Speaker 0 is an example. There are two statements that do not correspond to any speaker. Write your answers in the boxes provided. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1.5 minutes to read the questions. Speaker Zero.
I routinely point out that we could eliminate 80% of all chronic disease by using what we know. And we don't do that. We really bog down in bickering about, do we know what we know, and is this part of what we know more important than that part of what we know? And in no place is that a bigger problem than diet. There's obviously a lot of money to be made from confusion. Some years ago, I worked on air for Good Morning America. If you say the same thing about diet on air enough times in a row, people lose interest in your dietary segments. If you say something different every time, it's always interesting. But the result is we squander the opportunity to use what we know because we bog down in debate about what we don't know quite so well.
Speaker 1.
So I'm a physician, a nutritionist, and a trained chef. If you want people to eat healthy food, it has to taste good. I'm trying to find out specific foods that are nutrient-rich that you might enjoy. So what will it take to get me to get you to eat food more often? It's about finding what you enjoy, what tastes delicious, it's easy to prepare, you can find the ingredients in a local grocery store. So for me, when I think of adding food, we're going to add, number one, fiber. Not in breakfast cereal. I think of flour and sugar in the same thing. So I'm looking at adding fiber, as in vegetable, fruit, beans, and nuts, and getting 30 grams a day. And it's pretty easy to do if you actually show people how.
Speaker 2.
Diet is used in many ways in a spiritual life. The fascination that we have for food and for tastes can be a very wonderful and exciting adventure in life. But it can also be a distraction from the important work of life. All the tastes and sights and sounds of the world are the same. They're wonderful, they're amazing, they should be celebrated. But at the same time, we can use things like restraint in diet as a way to give us more time and energy to concentrate on more things that we would neglect in our lives. So the word in Sanskrit is tapas, or austerity. So you try to simplify your diet, to reduce it to the lowest common denominator so that it would be nutritious.
Speaker 3.
I just think people need more awareness in terms of where their food's coming. And I go back to that. I think that alone will help. I'm not opposed to putting restrictions on it. Like, right now I'm like, all right, we sell obviously a lot of pork, but like if we get pork belly, you know, there's two sizes of pork belly per pig. Like, these are a lot of animals that are being slaughtered for consumption. You know, it would be interesting to be like, oh, we've met our quota, we sold all the pork possible. In theory, I think that would be wonderful, but I don't know if that's practical. So part of right now it's like trying to balance what we want to do and what's actually practical. And maybe we'll get there in the future. I don't know. But, like, you know, I think there are a lot more problems in the vegetables that we grow than the meat we grow, right? Most people are consuming improperly grown vegetables.
Speaker 4.
What I've assembled is a list of real or traditional foods that are largely whole and unadulterated and produced and processed and prepared in the same way they once were. And I've found that those foods are all healthy. Each culture in each region had quite a limited diet. And what's interesting, if you look at the very limited diets, is that they're able to find all the nutrients that humans require. It may be that you or I could thrive on a vegan diet for a time, but there is no way to sustain human life and reproduction over many generations without foods of the sea and without foods of animal origin. We were not created as herbivores. We were created as omnivores, and there are a number of nutrients from vitamin B12 to vitamins A and D, which are found only in foods of animal origin, to long-chain omega-3 fats that you simply cannot get from leaves, no matter what the vegan sites will tell you.
Speaker 5.
Well, my main reason for eating local food is that local food tastes better. There are lots of side benefits to you, the ecology, and the farmer from eating local food. When you preserve foods in traditional manner, nutrients and the flavor are enhanced. And when the industrial food guys go about preserving foods, they remove perishable nutrients and reduce the flavor only to prolong the shelf life. Now, if you want to eat local food for reasons other than your own health and pleasure, there are many. If you eat the view, you're able to preserve the view. If you eat heritage breeds, which don't thrive in industrial production methods, then you preserve the biodiversity and genetics of all these rare animals. And we of course, reduce food miles and our carbon footprint by eating locally.
Speaker 6.
As far as your body is concerned, a grape from Chile is better than a cheeseburger from around the corner. If you're willing to eat a very limited diet, you can eat locally almost anywhere, at least in this country, all year round. And that's great, but it's expensive, it's inconvenient, and it takes dedication. I think it's a swell idea. And I think that ultimately, for food to make sense in this country, I think we're going to see more regionalism and less food coming out of California. And I think that if you want to be truly a local eater, you're not going to be drinking, if you live in the Northeast as I do, you're not going to be drinking any coffee, you're not going to be drinking any caffeinated tea, you're not going to be using any olive oil. There are a lot of things you're just going to be missing out on. That's fine if you think that that's the highest priority.
Now, listen again. Speaker 0.
I routinely point out that we could eliminate 80% of all chronic disease by using what we know. And we don't do that. We really bog down in bickering about, do we know what we know, and is this part of what we know more important than that part of what we know, and in no place is that a bigger problem than diet. There's obviously a lot of money to be made from confusion. Some years ago, I worked on air for Good Morning America. If you say the same thing about diet on air enough times in a row, people lose interest in your dietary segments. If you say something different every time, it's always interesting. But the result is we squander the opportunity to use what we know because we bog down in debate about what we don't know quite so well.
Speaker 1.
So I'm a physician, a nutritionist, and a trained chef. If you want people to eat healthy food, it has to taste good. I'm trying to find out specific foods that are nutrient-rich that you might enjoy. So what will it take to get me to get you to eat food more often? It's about finding what you enjoy, what tastes delicious, it's easy to prepare, you can find the ingredients in a local grocery store. So for me, when I think of adding food, we're going to add, number one, fiber. Not in breakfast cereal. I think of flour and sugar in the same thing. So I'm looking at adding fiber, as in vegetable, fruit, beans, and nuts, and getting 30 grams a day. And it's pretty easy to do if you actually show people how.
Speaker 2.
Diet is used in many ways in a spiritual life. The fascination that we have for food and for tastes can be a very wonderful and exciting adventure in life. But it can also be a distraction from the important work of life. All the tastes and sights and sounds of the world are the same. They're wonderful, they're amazing, they should be celebrated. But at the same time, we can use things like restraint in diet as a way to give us more time and energy to concentrate on more things that we would neglect in our lives. So the word in Sanskrit is tapas or austerity. So you try to simplify your diet to reduce it to the lowest common denominator so that it would be nutritious.
Speaker 3.
I just think people need more awareness in terms of where their food's coming. And I go back to that. I think that alone will help. I'm not opposed to putting restrictions on it. Like, right now I'm like, all right, we sell obviously a lot of pork, but like if we get pork belly, you know, there's two sides of pork belly per pig. Like, these are a lot of animals that are being slaughtered for consumption. You know, it would be interesting to be like, oh, we've met our quota. We sold all the pork possible. In theory, I think that would be wonderful, but I don't know if that's practical. So part of it right now, it's like trying to balance what we want to do and what's actually practical. And maybe we'll get there in the future. I don't know. But, like, you know, I think there are a lot more problems in the vegetables that we grow than the meat we grow, right? Most people are consuming improperly grown vegetables.
Speaker 4.
What I've assembled is a list of real or traditional foods that are largely whole and unadulterated and produced and processed and prepared in the same way they once were. And I've found that those foods are all healthy. Each culture in each region had quite a limited diet. And what's interesting, if you look at the very limited diets, is that they're able to find all the nutrients that humans require. It may be that you or I could thrive on a vegan diet for a time, but there is no way to sustain human life and reproduction over many generations without foods of the sea and without foods of animal origin. We were not created as herbivores. We were created as omnivores, and there are a number of nutrients from vitamin B12 to vitamins A and D, which are found only in foods of animal origin, to long-chain omega-3 fats that you simply cannot get from leaves, no matter what the vegan sites will tell you.
Speaker 5.
Well, my main reason for eating local food is that local food tastes better. There are lots of side benefits to you, the ecology, and the farmer from eating local food. When you preserve foods in traditional manner, nutrients and the flavor are enhanced. And when the industrial food guys go about preserving foods, they remove perishable nutrients and reduce the flavor only to prolong the shelf life. Now, if you want to eat local food for reasons other than your own health and pleasure, there are many. If you eat the view, you're able to preserve the view. If you eat heritage breeds, which don't thrive in industrial production methods, then you preserve the biodiversity and genetics of all these rare animals. And we of course, reduce food miles and our carbon footprint by eating locally.
Speaker 6.
As far as your body is concerned, a grape from Chile is better than a cheeseburger from around the corner. If you're willing to eat a very limited diet, you can eat locally almost anywhere, at least in this country, all year round. And that's great, but it's expensive, it's inconvenient, and it takes dedication. I think it's a swell idea. And I think that ultimately, for food to make sense in this country, I think we're going to see more regionalism and less food coming out of California. And I think that if you want to be truly a local eater, you're not going to be drinking, if you live in the Northeast as I do, you're not going to be drinking any coffee, you're not going to be drinking any caffeinated tea, you're not going to be using any olive oil. There are a lot of things you're just going to be missing out on. That's fine if you think that that's the highest priority.
Now you have 1 minute to check your answers. Please look at the third exercise. You will hear part of a documentary on Richard Branson, founder of the company Virgin Records. For questions 1 to 7, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C. Write your answers in the appropriate boxes below. Question 0 is an example. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1.5 minutes to read the questions.
In the early 1970s, a group of young men nicknamed the Earl's Court Hippies started on a fantastic journey of disruption. Headed by Richard Branson and guided by a sense that things could be done differently, the music business was set to be changed for good. The 16-year-old Richard started Student Magazine and then a Young People's Advisory Service from a private house he was renting in London's Albion Street. Breaking the rules was already in his DNA.
We were working out of a street just down the road and we weren't really meant to be working out of it. So the church commissioners that owned the house came in one day and we'd hidden all the telephones and everything in the cupboard and we were pretending that...
Your parents lived there.
Right.
And the phone started ringing in the cupboard. Yeah. So that's how we were.
So the local vicar said, I've got a crypt in my church, why don't you move in there?
It was extremely generous, obviously, of Reverend Cuthbert Scott. Moving to the crypt was highly unsatisfactory. Had people been paid, there would have been a strike. The ceilings were extremely low, there was no natural light. You know, the tombs served as desks.
We were always nervous, as you can see, that the grave would cave in on us.
After noticing the students working on the magazine would rather buy the latest hot record than a hot meal, he realised the time was ripe for a discounted mail-order record service. So he put an advert in the back of Student Magazine, and the Virgin brand was born.
We packed up the mail-order records from here. It was busy, thriving atmosphere.
The first thing I did when I started there in early 71 is to sort of work out ways of importing records, and then we started doing importing records that were going to come out in England, but where there was a time lag. So we could advertise the new Joni Mitchell album or the new Mother's Invention album and sell hundreds of copies at import prices.
The fledgling company was already making waves in the music business and orders came in thick and fast.
Until there was a six-week postal strike.
That basically meant no money was coming in.
We couldn't send any records out, so the whole place was piling up and then grinding to a halt.
So Richard said we had to find a shop, like within a week, and we did. It really rescued us.
Selling records the Virgin way spread to Notting Hill Gate and then Liverpool. But not all rules in the music business were made to be broken.
The morning I opened Bow Street was also the morning you were arrested. We had been able to pass on certain savings from the taxman to the customer.
They fined us three times what we'd saved. So over the next couple of years, we expanded to something like 20 or 30 record shops and we just used the turnover to pay off the fine.
Tubular Bells became the biggest selling album of 1973, overturning conventions of selling albums and firmly establishing Virgin as the new label on the block. Over the next few years, Virgin expanded. Richard was now living on his houseboat Duende, and the offices moved to Vernon Yard just off Portobello Road. But they struggled to repeat the success of their first signing until 1977.
I actually heard one of the Pistols records for the first time in Henneke's there.
I rang up the chairman of EMI, and in those days, he wouldn't talk to me personally. And I left a message saying if he wanted to get rid of his embarrassment, could he give me a ring? And I got a fairly curt message back saying thank you very much, but we're quite happy with the Sex Pistols. The next morning, after they'd appeared on the Bill Grundy show the night before, I was woken up at my home, and it was the chairman personally on the phone. And he said, if you want them, you can have them. We rang into problems with the law over the name Bollocks.
It was deemed illegal to use the word bollocks in a public place under the 1824 Vagrancy Act, and the police were going to take us to court for all sorts of things. So we did a poster in the window to reassure our customers that we knew right from wrong. The heading of the poster was the Metropolitan Police Authority, then it said the 1824 Vagrancy Act, and on these grounds we couldn't advertise, never mind the bollocks. And underneath this it said, but don't worry, we know best. And then it was signed, the Metropolitan Police. And we stuck this in the window, and a lot of people, not excluding the Metropolitan Police, got really cross, which we were delighted about.
So I rang up a linguistics expert at Nottingham University, and the professor there said that the police were talking a lot of bollocks, and that actually the word bollocks was a nickname given to priests in the 18th century, and that he would be happy to come to court. And he happened to be a priest himself, and so would I mind if he wore his dog collar? And, of course, he was delighted, and he turned up at court with his dog collar on, and the judge reluctantly found us not guilty.
Post-punk, Richard successfully launches Virgin in the French market with Julian Clerc and Telephone, but fails to crack the USA, costing the company £900,000. By 1980, the label is struggling financially.
singles didn't turn into albums. It was a difficult time. But what was so terribly exciting was signing Phil Collins in 1980. There was discussion, argument within the organisation. Could we afford to pay the advance for that small territory? And indeed, it turned out to be an absolutely excellent A&R acquisition of the Human League. Two albums in. Should we carry on with them? Should we not? We carried on with the third album, and that third album became their greatest album, Dare, and that enormous hit, Don't You Want Me.
Virgin Records' success continues throughout the 80s with artists such as UB40 and Peter Gabriel, and had become the label of choice of emerging talent. And they finally cracked the American market with both Paula Abdul and Steve Winwood at the top of the US charts.
I think we had a tremendous group of musicians. We were proud of the fact that no musician ever left the record label, and that's why Virgin grew into the most successful independent record label in the world.
By the early 90s, it was clear just how far this once tiny independent label had come, and the brand was truly global, fronted by the distinctive megastores. In the new musical landscape of the 21st century, the label's going back to the ideals of those Earl's Court hippies. Virgin EMI is showing it's serious about shaking things up for a long time to come.
Now, listen again.
In the early 1970s, a group of young men nicknamed the Earl's Court Hippies started on a fantastic journey of disruption. Headed by Richard Branson and guided by a sense that things could be done differently, the music business was set to be changed for good. The 16-year-old Richard started Student Magazine and then a Young People's Advisory Service from a private house he was renting in London's Albion Street. Breaking the rules was already in his DNA.
We were working out of a street just down the road, and we weren't really meant to be working out of it. So the church commissioners that owned the house came in one day, and we'd hidden all the telephones and everything in the cupboard, and we were pretending that...
Your parents lived there.
Right.
And the phone started ringing in the cupboard, yeah. So that's how we were.
So the local vicar said, I've got a crypt in my church, why don't you move in there?
It was extremely generous, obviously, of Reverend Cuthbert Scott. Moving to the crypt was highly unsatisfactory. Had people been paid, there would have been a strike. The ceilings were extremely low, there was no natural light. You know, the tombs served as desks.
We're always nervous, as you can see, that the grave would cave in on us.
After noticing the students working on the magazine would rather buy the latest hot record than a hot meal, he realised the time was ripe for a discounted mail-order record service. So he put an advert in the back of Student Magazine, and the Virgin brand was born.
We packed up the mail-order records from here. It was busy, thriving atmosphere.
The first thing I did when I started there in the early 71 is to sort of work out ways of importing records, and then we started doing importing records that were going to come out in England, but where there was a time lag. So we could advertise the new Joni Mitchell album or the new Mother's Invention album and sell hundreds of copies at import prices.
The fledgling company was already making waves in the music business, and orders came in thick and fast.
Until there was a six-week postal strike.
That basically meant no money was coming in.
We couldn't send any records out, so the whole place was piling up and then grinding to a halt.
So Richie said we had to find a shop, like, within a week, and we did. It really rescued us.
Selling records the Virgin way spread to Notting Hill Gate and then Liverpool. But not all rules in the music business were made to be broken.
The morning I opened Bow Street was also the morning you were arrested. We had been able to pass on certain savings from the taxman to the customer.
They fined us three times what we'd saved. So over the next couple of years, we expanded something like 20 or 30 record shops, and we just used the turnover to pay off the fine.
Tubular Bells became the biggest selling album of 1973, overturning conventions of selling albums and firmly establishing Virgin as the new label on the block. Over the next few years, Virgin expanded. Richard was now living on his houseboat Duende, and the offices moved to Vernon Yard just off Portobello Road. But they struggled to repeat the success of their first signing until 1977.
I actually heard one of the Pistols records for the first time in Henneke's there.
I rang up the chairman of EMI, and in those days, he wouldn't talk to me personally. And I left a message saying if he wanted to get rid of his embarrassment, could he give me a ring? And I got a fairly curt message back saying thank you very much, but we're quite happy with the Sex Pistols. The next morning, after they'd appeared on the Bill Grundy show the night before, I was woken up at my home, and it was the chairman personally on the phone. And he said, if you want them, you can have them. We rang into problems with the law over the name Bollocks.
It was deemed illegal to use the word bollocks in a public place under the 1824 Vagrancy Act, and the police were going to, you know, take us to court for all sorts of things. So we did a poster in the window to reassure our customers that we knew right from wrong. The heading of the poster was the Metropolitan Police Authority. Then it said the 1824 Vagrancy Act, and on these grounds, we couldn't advertise, never mind the bollocks. And underneath this it said, but don't worry, we know best. And then it was signed, the Metropolitan Police. And we stuck this in the window, and a lot of people, not excluding the Metropolitan Police, got really cross, which we were delighted about.
Yes, so I rang up a linguistics expert at Nottingham University, and the professor there said that the police were talking a lot of bollocks, and that actually the word bollocks was a nickname given to priests in the 18th century, and that he would be happy to come to court. And he happened to be a priest himself, and so would I mind if he wore his dog collar? And, of course, was delighted, and he turned up at court with his dog collar on, and the judge reluctantly found us not guilty.
Post-punk, Richard successfully launches Virgin in the French market with Julian Clerc and Telephone, but fails to crack the USA, costing the company £900,000. By 1980, the label is struggling financially.
Singles didn't turn into albums. It was a difficult time. But what was so terribly exciting was signing Phil Collins in 1980. There was discussion, argument within the organisation. Could we afford to pay the advance for that small territory? And indeed, it turned out to be an absolutely excellent A&R acquisition of the Human League. Two albums in. Should we carry on with them? Should we not? We carried on with the third album, and that third album became their greatest album, Dare, and that enormous hit, Don't You Want Me.
Virgin Records' success continues throughout the 80s with artists such as UB40 and Peter Gabriel, and had become the label of choice of emerging talent. And they finally cracked the American market with both Paula Abdul and Steve Winwood at the top of the US charts.
I think we had a tremendous group of musicians. We were proud of the fact that no musician ever left the record label, and that's why Virgin grew into the most successful independent record label in the world.
By the early 90s, it was clear just how far this once tiny independent label had come, and the brand was truly global, fronted by the distinctive megastores. In the new musical landscape of the 21st century, the label's going back to the ideals of those Earl's Court hippies. Virgin EMI is showing it's serious about shaking things up for a long time to come.
Now you have 1 minute to check your answers. This is the end of the English Listening Comprehension Test, C2 Level, Valencian Community, 2016.